Morning Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers. The latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, everyone. Today is Sunday, April 14th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages, and I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look at the pictures on the front page of each paper. On the front page of the New York Times is a picture of a young man. His name is Nestor Babsky, 23. We'll be hearing about him in a couple minutes, and he's working at a rehab center in Ukraine. And there's a new law now that makes the draft more personal. I believe it said in the article that the draft age has been lowered to the age of 25 from 27. And the picture is that he's assisting a couple of swimmers who are in a pool. Looks like he's timing them. That's that picture. And then over to the Hartford Courant. Big news yesterday was, of course, the UConn men's basketball parade. And there's a picture of many of the players on the podium. Looks like Coach Hurley is speaking at the moment. Donovan Klingon is raising his arm and holding the trophy. And some 60,000 people turn out as the Huskies celebrated the school's repeat championship. Underneath there's another picture of a bus. A big bus with the players in the back of it standing up, waving, and the throng of people down below waving and cheering and taking pictures. That will be my first story from the Hartford Courant. So we're going to go over to the story on the New York Times, and it's actually not a story. It's little... I don't know if you call them tidbits, but little information on some of the young men in Ukraine who are anticipating that they may be drafted. So there's like, I think there's like five of them that I'm going to read about. First, I'll read the introductory paragraph. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine probably changed the fates of thousands of Ukrainian men this month when he signed a law lowering the draft age to 25 from 27. More than 2 years after Russia began its full-scale invasion, Ukrainian forces are struggling to hold back the far larger Russian army and desperately need their ranks replenished. Now, many of the young men who remain in Ukraine, thousands of others have illegally fled the country, worry about their future. Reporters from the New York Times spoke to Ukrainian men who could be affected by the change. And as I said, there's about five different men that are featured here, and I'll describe the picture. The first one, his name is Vasil Vanshurik. He's sitting on a couch or a bed, and his mother looks like she's preparing dinner. His father had joined the military, and he says, "My parents are more worried." And I'll read the little information here. Vasil Vanshurik, 24, is a sawmill worker in western Ukraine's Carpathian Mountains. He said that he had wanted to enlist, but that his father had gone off to fight, leaving him to take care of his mother and other relatives in the war's early months. "Am I worried? Yes and no," Mr. Vanshurik said. "My parents are more worried about me going to the army than I am." He said he realized that with such a brutal war going on, they still need people there. The second picture is that of the young man that I described at the beginning of the broadcast when I was describing the picture. His name is Nestor Babsky, and he right now is helping wounded Ukrainian soldiers during a therapy session at the rehabilitation center where he works. That's the picture. Here's what he says. "I was terrified at the thought of going to war." Nestor Babsky, 23, a physical therapist at a rehabilitation center in western Ukraine, sees several Ukrainian soldiers a day who have been wounded and maimed by the war. He said he felt guilt about not having served himself and a sense of dread for what lay ahead. "At first, Mr. Babsky said, I was terrified at the thought of going to war, but now I am calm about it. The wounded soldiers have played their role and returned to live their lives, so I'm waiting for my time to come. He added, I realize that I will definitely be more useful there than here. This thought calms me down. Now, the picture is a picture of a young man, Maxim Suki. He is working out in a gym and completing an obstacle course on a training ground near Kyiv. Here's what he says. I need to be as professional as possible. Maxim Suki, 27, a dental technician in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, had already reached the minimum conscription age when the law was signed on April 3rd. He said he had been training to go to war since August 2022, but had yet to enlist. He has been looking for a unit to join while learning about weapons and tactics at a camp on the weekends and going to the gym. Training in Ukrainian military units is often uneven at best, and those men who are drafted, rather than the ones who join voluntarily, are often assigned to the infantry. Those ground troops usually pull the hardest duty, sitting in trenches under heavy shelling and attacking enemy lines if need be. Mr. Suki said he was bracing for such possibilities. I need to be as professional as possible. If I go to war, I also want to be a professional there, he said. Therefore, I prepare for possible mobilization as much as time and financial resources allow. If I end up at war, I don't want to be someone who knows nothing. And continuing with the pictures, there's a picture of a young man. Looks like they're in a steam bath at a gym. And the man featured here is Igor Kamchenko. He's the owner of a communal bakery. He's sitting here with other men on the bench in the steam bath. He turns 25 next month. Said he had many friends who had gone to war. But he said that his wife, Amelia, had told him that she would, quote, do everything possible to prevent me from being taken away if he were to be drafted. I am worried, even a little scared, Mr. Kamchenko said, but everything will be as God intended. Mr. Kamchenko lives in Dukiva, an industrial town in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. Russia has shelled the town with missiles and artillery, but life goes on, even though on most nights you can hear the rumble of fighting on the front line nearby. At the beginning of the war, his wife, then pregnant, traveled to the central Ukraine city of Dnipro. She returned home after giving birth to their son. She feels quite calm here because our family is together. We can't imagine living separately and don't know how people separated by war for months and years can cope with this ordeal, he said. Of course, when there is shelling in Druzhivia, Amelia is scared, but we are strong together, he added. The next picture is a picture of a man named Denis Yemets. He's an electrician at a steel plant in southern Ukraine. He just turned 25. He's walking along the street with his fiancée in the picture. He said he was not too worried about the change in the draft since he believed he was needed more at the steel plant than in the army. But if called up, he would go fight, he said. I've already gotten used to the idea that this war, unfortunately, will last a long time. At first, we all hoped that it would be over quickly, but later it turned out that reality is much harsher. Mr. Yemes said that his uncle and stepfather, who had already fought in the war, had discouraged him from fighting. They really did not want me to follow in their footsteps and serve in the army, he said. I am the only male descendant left in the family, and they are very worried that I won't be okay, he said. They would definitely want me to stay at the plant and continue to support my mother, aunt, and grandmother. Generations of Ukrainians were upended when Russia invaded. As the war continues with no end in sight, Ukraine's youngest are in increasing peril, at risk of being dragged toward the carnage of ground combat as they defend their homeland. On the front lines, their fate will be decided by, as the English World War I poet Wilfred Owen once wrote, quote, chances strange arithmetic. And the final one is a picture of Oleksandr Manchenko working with his partner, and they are taking their cat for grooming. Up on the top, and he says, actually, I have that wrong. This is a man named Oleksandr Manchenko, 26, a journalist from Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, and there's a picture of a soldier climbing over, looks like an a group of tires, maybe an obstacle course, practicing. Anyway, Alexander Manchenko has covered the war, noted the tough calculation that President Zelensky had probably faced in lowering draft age. Most young people are the future, no matter how trite it may sound, Mr. Manchenko said. Perhaps he thought that Ukraine could do without mobilizing young people, but apparently the military situation does not allow us to have such a luxury, he said. Mr. Manchenko said he respected the bravery of those who enlisted in the early days of the war. It is thanks to them that we survived, adding that he doubted his own courage and did not want to fight. Furthermore, he says, I want to continue doing what I am doing because I think my work is also important. But I'm not going to run away from mobilization and hide, so we'll see how my fate unfolds. So there's a brief snippets of some men in Ukraine in the age where they could possibly be drafted and their reaction and feelings towards it. Now we're going to go over to the current. And the picture is, as I described, and then the caption is the picture of the UConn men up on the podium, and they're waving. Coach Hurley is speaking. Here's the story. The headline, Emotional Farewell. Donovan Klingon, at 7 feet two, had to stoop to get to the mic, and he kept his valedictorian short on one point, about 25 seconds. Let's go back to back, champs. What do you say, he said, as the UConn fans bunched together on Trumbull Street as far as he could see. These last 2 years I'll cherish the rest of my life. I'll be a Husky for life. Love you guys. It was an exuberant day for the UConn men's basketball team, 5 days past their victory over Purdue for the national championship, the second in a row and the program's sixth since 1999. But Saturday was also a sad day, despite the crowd estimated at 60,000 people by Hartford police that turned out to cheer and celebrate on the streets and in front of the XL Center. These parades take on the emotions of a graduation day, regardless of how many years a player has been in college. There is euphoria because the mission was accomplished, but sadness that the chase for the trophy is over and the gang will be moving on in separate directions. That's how you want people to feel. You want that emotional connection, Coach Dan Hurley said. I think you get that because of the success, but you get that when people work hard together, strive for hard things together. That connection you build is lifelong, and it's emotional. He goes on to say, I know these guys here. These are the best teams that they will ever be on. They will never feel connection to a group like they do in college. The NBA, professional sports, is very businesslike. They're never going to feel like this again until they're a dad or a husband. Klingon is one of those who have been through this twice. Last season as a freshman, he might have tried to move to the NBA, but was convinced another year at UConn, in which he would play a larger role with Adama Sanogo moving on, would be beneficial. The sophomore from Bristol Central High, Klingon did all a college basketball player can do in 2 years, and he announced Friday he would go to the NBA. It's time to matriculate. It's been so special to be able to leave my mark on UConn history, Klingon said. It was very hard for me to go up there and talk to the coaches, talk about leaving. The consensus of basketball analysis is that he will be picked high, perhaps even number one in the NBA draft, so he had to go. Millions of dollars are all but guaranteed. I wanted to say, Klingon said, maybe half joking, but coach said I couldn't. And I think I'm going to read the rest of that article because it's almost time for the weather. Stefan Castle, just a freshman who started during the NCAA tournament, scoring 36 points at the Final Four, is in a similar situation. And though he is not ready to announce his decision, he sounded a lot like Klingon. Whether I stay or leave, I know I'll be in a great situation. If I leave, I'll be able to make it better for my family. If I stay, I'll still be in still be coached by the best coach in college basketball, so the decision is not tough. It's just a matter of making the right one. At most programs in the country, players become antsy to leave, either for greener fields at other schools where more opportunities for name, image, likeness, money might be available, or the very green pastures of the NBA. When players are reluctant, Hurley had to talk to Andre Jackson Jr., now with the Milwaukee Bucks, into leaving last year. That's the sign of a program's central coach-player relationships. This UConn team had extraordinary chemistry, blending holdovers from last year's championship, including Klingon, Alex Carabon, Tristan Newton, and Hassan Diarra, with newcomers Cam Spencer, a grad student in Castle, hungry to experience their own parade and ceremony. Once we got on the court together as a team, we knew we had a special group, Spencer said. We knew if we do the right things and the coaches put us in the right positions to be successful, we could accomplish anything. Age-wise, it balanced us out. Guys like Steph are really mature, easy to play with, and they keep an old guy like me young. Spencer, 23, saw a number of signs held by female fans proposing marriage. Oh, I don't know about that. It's a big commitment. The older players did what they could to prepare the others for their first parade, but it was best not to spoil it. They had to experience it for themselves. They just said, it's insane. Couldn't really describe it, Spencer said. The flooding of people throughout the street, they just said it was an incredible experience they wanted to have as well. Now will come the long victory tour back to the ballparks in New York and Boston, to Wall Street, the White House, eventually reaching the last time the group will be together. Hurley will be balancing all of that as he works to reload the team for the three-peat, which he proclaimed as the next goal. On social media, he posted a photo of himself lying on the floor in his office as if passed out, captioned day one in the transfer portal. Hurley, too, experienced periods of melancholy in the months following the championship in 2023, and the way he is wired probably will again. Graduations can be as emotional and hard on the teachers who know they will say goodbye to a group, in this case a group that made history and made their coach the most famous in the country. Hurley made it clear he doesn't want to coach college basketball anywhere else. Just going back 6 months, what it took since June, the work that went into it, Hurley said, the realization you come to, you put together teams and not all-star teams. We want to keep putting together these types of teams with our types of guys. And now we are going to go to the weather. I have the forecast from the national forecast from the Times. A storm will travel across the Great Lakes today, bringing showers and thunderstorms. Thunderstorms can become heavy to even severe in portions of Ohio and Pennsylvania and will be capable of producing damaging winds and hail in the afternoon and at night. Showers and thunderstorms will continue from California to Oregon and Idaho. There can be a zone of steadier rain in Northern California and Southern Oregon. Thunderstorms can bring hail in parts of Central and Southern California. Dry weather will continue as high pressure remains in control. Temperatures will trend 10 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit above historical averages across the center of the nation. And here's the local forecast for today through next Thursday. Today, breezy, a couple of afternoon showers. The high will be 61. Monday, partly sunny and nice. The high will be 66. Tuesday looks like the best day of the week. It's going to be warm with sunshine. The high 71 degrees. Wednesday, showers around in the morning, mostly cloudy. The high will be 62. And on Thursday, 53 degrees. The high will be 58. I'm going to go back to the front page of the Current, and I'm going to read this story from Jerusalem. Iran launched dozens of drones and ballistic missiles toward Israel late Saturday in an unprecedented revenge mission that pushed the Middle East ever closer to a region-wide war. The attack marked the first time Iran had ever launched a direct military assault on Israel, despite decades of enmity dating back to the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution. Israel's military said over 100 drones had been fired, but its air defenses were prepared for the attack and it was ready to respond. It did mention ballistic missiles, which are less easily shot down, but Iran said they were part of the attack. The U.S., with its large troop presence in the region, said it would provide unspecified support to Israel. We are monitoring the threat, Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari announced in a nationwide television address, saying it would take several hours for the drones to reach Israel. The Israeli military said it could not confirm whether it had intercepted any drones or what their targets were. Iran had vowed revenge since an April 1st airstrike in Syria, killing two Iranian generals inside an Iranian consular building. Iran accused Israel of being behind the attack. Israel hasn't commented on it. Israel and Iran have been on a collision course throughout Israel's six-month war against Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip. The war erupted after Hamas and Islamic Jihad, two militant groups backed by Iran, carried out a devastating cross-border attack October 7th that killed 1,200 people in Israel and kidnapped 250. An Israeli offensive in Gaza has caused widespread devastation and killed over 33,000 people, according to local health officials. Another story on the front page of The Current. Every 2 weeks, Kirk Murad gets a message from the police department in the area of Japan where his wife, Patty Wu Murad, went missing a year ago. When the new message pops up on WhatsApp, he always feels a bit of hope. Maybe they found her. Maybe there is some new information, but there's nothing. The updates are the same. We continue to search. We have found nothing, is basically what they say, said Murad, who lives in Mansfield. On Thursday, we will continue the search, he said. You keep hoping that there's something. Every time I get the message, I read it right away, and nothing. On March 4th, 2023, Kirk dropped Patty, his wife of 33 years, off at Newark Airport. That was the last time he saw her. Patty, 60, was retired from her job at United Technologies and was an experienced hiker who had traveled all over the world. On the morning of April 10th, she set out to hike 11.2 miles on the Kamano Kodo Trail in a mountainous area of Japan. The owner of the hostel where she had stayed the night before pointed her to the trailhead, and that was the last time anyone reported seeing her. Murad had spoken to his wife the week before. She told him she might not be able to contact him because she was in a remote area, so he thought nothing of it when he didn't hear from her for a few days. He got a call from the U.S. Embassy on April 14th telling him she was missing, and the local police had been looking for her, and he immediately rushed to Japan with his daughter, Murphy, and son, Bryce. A GoFundMe page set up by Murphy raised over $200,000, and the Murads were able to bring American search and rescue teams over to Japan and pay a Japanese SAR team. The American search and rescue teams had to go home, and eventually Kirk, Murphy, and Bryce left too because they couldn't afford to stay in the country. They wanted to put their remaining money towards search and rescue efforts, but eventually the Japanese team stopped officially searching as well. There was video footage of Patty arriving at the guest house April 9th, where she spent the night, and photos of her at the guest house that night, Murad said. Murad said the police took a statement from the innkeeper, who said that he walked Wu Murad out of the guest house and pointed her toward the trail ahead. Numerous search and rescue teams and the Murads combed through the area and could not find Patty. This is how it was when we were there, Murad said. They'd search, we'd get the debriefing at the end of the day, hoping they found her, and they didn't. I'm trying to mitigate the disappointment. It's hard to say hopeful, hard to stay hopeful when all you get is disappointment. And we have one more story on the front page of The Current. With less than 7 months remaining until Election Day, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy holds a commanding lead in the money race for re-election with more than $9 million in the bank. The two-term Democrat has been developing a national profile on issues like gun control, immigration, and the war in Gaza. But he is simultaneously focusing on a bid to win a third term representing Connecticut. Murphy recently announced that he had raised $1.4 million in the just-concluded first quarter, which boosted his cash on hand beyond $9 million. Of that, 97% of the contributions were $100 or less. Abortion rights, gun safety, the future of our democracy, it's all on the line in November, Murphy said. Representing the people of Connecticut and Washington is the best job in the world, and I'm grateful for their generous support. Murphy's three potential opponents, Republican First Selectman Gerard Jerry Smith of the small town of Beacon Falls, former portfolio manager John J. Flynn of Norwalk and landscaper Robert F. Hyde of Simsbury do not have widespread name recognition and have never held statewide office. In the same way, many voters would be unable to recall the name of Murphy's 2018 opponent. The answer is Matthew Corey, a hardworking Republican restaurant owner and high-rise window washer who lost to Murphy by about 60% to 40%. Saying that he raised $34,000 in this year's first quarter, Smith conceded that collecting money is difficult without the Republican nomination that he is seeking at the party's convention in New Britain on May 13th. He's also trying to capture at least 85% of the delegates in order to block an August primary so that he can focus exclusively on Murphy, who has a war chest that Smith said is not necessary in a small state like Connecticut. I definitely think it's overkill, Smith told The Current in an interview. Money is not going to win this election, and money won't lose the election. Do I need $9 million? No, but I need significantly more than I have. It's tough enough to raise money as a Republican in this state. If I need to raise money to fight another Republican in a primary before I can even raise the money to fight a Democrat, it would just be insane. And now we are going to move on to the World and Nation section of The Current. President Joe Biden has nearly erased Donald Trump's early polling advantage amid signs that the Democratic base has begun to coalesce behind the president despite lingering doubts about the direction of the country, the economy, and his age, according to a new survey by the New York Times and Siena College. Biden and Trump are now virtually tied, with Trump holding a 46% to 45% edge. This is an improvement for Biden from late February, when Trump had a sturdier 48% to 43% lead just before he became the presumptive Republican nominee. Biden's tick upward appears to stem largely from his improved standing among traditional Democratic voters. He is winning a greater share of voters who supported him in 2020 than he did a month ago. The tightening poll results are the latest evidence of a 2024 contest that both campaigns are preparing to be excruciatingly close. Beneath the narrowing contest, many of the fundamentals of the race appear largely unchanged. The share of voters who view the nation as headed in the wrong direction remains a high 64%. Almost 80% of voters still rate the nation's economic conditions as fair or poor, including a majority of Democrats. And Biden and Trump remain unpopular for familiar reasons. Most voters think Biden is too old. A majority believe Trump has committed serious federal crimes. Yet, despite the potential for the Republican nominee to face jail time, only one in four voters said they were paying very close attention to Trump's legal travails. And I have another story. This is from Pittsburgh. More than two dozen barges broke loose from their moorings and floated down the Ohio River in Pittsburgh, striking one bridge that had already been preemptively closed and damaging a marina, officials said. The boats eventually were pinned to the riverbank or went over a dam downstream. Pittsburgh Police, Fire, and Emergency Medical Services responded about 11:25 p.m. Friday to reports of the barges floating uncontrolled down the river, Pittsburgh Public Safety said in a statement. The area had been hit by flooding after heavy rains on Thursday. The Sewickley Bridge was struck by a barge a few minutes before 2 p.m. Saturday, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation said. It was closed in advance of the strike and will remain closed until our crews, this is a quote, complete an inspection, spokesperson Steve Cohen said. Officials in Moon Township, which is connected by the bridge to the community of Sewickley, earlier said the span would be temporarily closed due to unmanned barge passing through. 11 of the 26 barges that broke free were quickly contained to one side by a towing vessel just downstream, said Commander Justin Jolly of the Coast Guard Marine Safety Unit in Pittsburgh. Nine others were collected at the Ensworth Lock and Dam downstream. Five or six barges went through the dam. Four ended up just downstream at a lock and dam, while another ended up on the riverbank and was stabilized. Marine safety units were searching for one barge, Jolly said. Pittsburgh public safety officials reported damage to Piggy's Harbor, a marina on the river. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette said the McKees Rocks Bridge was closed as a precaution but reopened after inspection. 23 of the barges were carrying dry cargo, mostly coal, and at least one was loaded with fertilizer, according to the owner, Jolly said. Three were empty. No hazardous materials were on any of the vessels, the city said. The Coast Guard put out a broadcast notice to mariners to inform them about the potential hazard, but high water was preventing traffic on the river, Jolly said. The barges were owned or operated by Campbell Transportation Company, the city's statement said. Jolly said Coast Guard officials are working with the owner on a salvage plan. And we are going to stop now and take another break and then be back with more front pages after that.
The American School for the Deaf Online Academy is the first accessible online education platform for deaf and hard of hearing students, serving over 200 students from around the world. It offers core academic subjects for middle and high school students, tutoring, enrichment programs, and American Sign Language as a world language courses for public schools. The program recently expanded to also provide accessible support services, including speech therapy and counseling. This telecare program offers direct access to therapeutic services for deaf and hard of hearing school-aged children without the need for an interpreter or third party. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf. Always able.
And my next story is from Jerusalem. An Israeli teenager whose disappearance had led to riots by Israeli settlers in the West Bank was found dead Saturday, Israeli authorities said, threatening to further inflame tensions in the Israeli-occupied territory. Dozens of Israelis and Palestinians were wounded during classes during Saturday at several locations across the West Bank, the Israeli military said in a statement. Israeli extremists stormed at least two villages in the territory, attempting to burn Palestinian property and clashing with residents, according to Palestinian witnesses. Benjamin Achemeyer, 14, had left a farming settlement in the West Bank to herd sheep Friday morning, but he never returned, Israeli police said. Israeli forces later found his corpse, and the military said he had been murdered in a terrorist attack without providing evidence. After Benjamin's disappearance, armed Israeli settlers stormed a Palestinian village near Ramallah, torching several buildings and cars, according to Palestinian officials, said Yesh Din, an Israeli rights group. One Palestinian man, Jihad Abdu Aliya, was killed during the clashes, and at least 25 were wounded, the village mayor, Amin Abdu Aliya, said. And we have a story from Las Vegas. The executor of O.J. Simpson's estate says he will work to prevent a payout of a $33.5 million judgment awarded by a California civil jury nearly three decades ago in a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the families of Simpson's ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. Simpson's will was filed Friday in a Clark County court in Nevada, naming his longtime lawyer Malcolm Laverney as the executor. The document shows that Simpson's property was placed into a trust that was created this year. Laverne told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that the entirety of Simpson's estate has not been tallied. Under Nevada law, an estate must go through the courts if its assets exceed $20,000. Simpson died Wednesday without having paid the lion's share of the civil judgment that was awarded in 1997 after jurors found him liable. With his assets set to go through the court probate process, the Goldman and Brown families could be in line to get paid a piece of whatever Simpson left behind. Laverne, who had represented Simpson since 2009, said he specifically didn't want the Goldman family seeing any money from Simpson's estate. "It's my hope that the Goldmans get zero, nothing," he told the Review-Journal, "them specifically, and I will do everything in my capacity as the executor of or personal representative to try and ensure that they get nothing." From Kyiv, Ukraine's military chief warned Saturday that the battlefield situation in the industrial east has significantly worsened in recent days as warming weather allowed Russian forces to launch a fresh push along several stretches of the 620-mile front line. In an update on the Telegram messaging app, General Oleksandr Syrsky said Moscow has significantly ramped up its assaults since President Vladimir Putin extended his nearly quarter-century rule in a preordained election last month that saw anti-war candidates barred from the ballot and independent voices silenced in a Kremlin-backed media blockade. According to Syrsky, Russian forces have been actively attacking Ukrainian positions in three areas of the eastern Donetsk region near the cities of Lyman, Bakhmut, and Pokrovsk, and beginning to launch tank assaults as drier, warmer spring weather has made it easier for heavy vehicles to move across previously muddy terrain. Despite significant losses, the enemy is intensifying its efforts by using new units equipped with armored vehicles, thanks to which it periodically achieves tactical success, Syrsky said. On Saturday, a Russian Defense Ministry spokesman confirmed the capture of a village that had been the site of fierce fighting for close to 18 months. Analysts from Ukraine's non-governmental Deep State Group, which tracks frontline developments, had reported on Russia's takeover of Pervomaisky, about 28 miles southeast of Pokrovsk, in the early hours of Thursday. The group said in a Telegram update Saturday that Moscow's forces had also taken Bohdanovka, another eastern village close to Bakhmut, where the war's bloodiest battle raged for 9 months until it fell to Russia last May. Ukraine's defense ministry shortly afterward denied that Bohdiva had been captured, saying intense fighting continued there. And we're going to move over now to the Connecticut section of the Current for the rest of our stories. And the first one I have is local names win prestigious award. Of the 188 people chosen to be Guggenheim Fellows in 2024, quite a few have ties to Connecticut. The awards have been given annually since 1925 and are considered among the most prestigious honors given to leading figures in arts, sciences, and humanities. Most of the Connecticut-related names on this year's list are affiliated with Yale University. Yale is second only to Harvard in the number of faculty members that have received Guggenheim Fellowships over the years. The Yale-based 2024 fellows are, and here's the list, Elizabeth Hinton, a professor of history, African American studies, and law at both Yale University and Yale Law School; Douglas Rogers, professor and chair of the Yale Department of Anthropology; Marta Figlerowitz, Associate Professor of Comparative Literature and of English; Ned Blackhawk, Professor of History and American Studies; Tavia Nyong'o, Chair and Professor of Theater and Performance Studies, as well as Professor of American Studies and Professor of African American Studies; Travis Zad, Professor of Religious Studies and the Program in Medieval Studies, who was also on the Council of Middle East Studies and the Director of the Yale Program in Iranian Studies; and Ben Haggerty, a lecturer at the Yale School of Art. And here are some other Connecticut Guggenheim Fellows: playwright Martina Majok, a 2012 graduate of the Yale School of Drama. Majok's play Sanctuary City is currently playing at Theater Works Hartford on Pearl Street through April 25th. Legendary jazz guitarist and composer Rodney Jones, a New Haven native and longtime Connecticut resident; Julia Wolfe, who co-founded the eminent neoclassical music ensembles Bang on a Can with two Yale School of Music graduates. And another one, she has been in Connecticut many times as a member of the group, including for performances at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. Another one is multifaceted dancer and scholar Hari Krishman, a Wesleyan University professor who had taught in the dance department as well as in global South Asian studies and feminist gender and sexuality study programs. Krishman is currently developing a new dance piece that will premiere at Wesleyan in December. Among the many other 2024 Guggenheim Awards are Pulitzer-winning poet and former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, political journalist Jonathan Alter, photographer Sarah Bennett, known for her studies of incarcerated women, social activist Jessica Blinkhorn, indigenous artist Nicholas Gallinan, and octogenarian multidisciplinary Boston artist Lorraine O'Grady. The prestigious awards include monetary stipends. The exact amounts given to the awardees this year has not been disclosed, but are said to be an average between $40,000 and $50,000. Jessica Bulkholz puts her heart into saving wildlife. Her work as a state-certified wildlife rehabilitator is done on a volunteer basis and through Wild Hearts Animal Rehabilitation in Middletown. It all started years ago when she came upon an injured baby fox, she said. He appeared to have a broken leg, likely from being hit by a car. My heart broke for this poor baby as cars continued to pass by around him. Using a blanket from my car, I gently scooped him up and got him to safety, she said. While she now has been a state-certified wildlife rehabilitator for 6 years, at the time she found the fox, she had been a pet sitter whose business, Paw Prints, is located in Middletown. Her motivation to protect and rehabilitate wildlife was a journey from concerned citizen to certified wildlife rehabilitator, she said. Wildlife rehabilitators go to great lengths, largely at their own expense, to save injured and compromised creatures, she said. In dealing with the baby fox, also known as a kit, she did lots of research on Google and identified a veterinarian who, quote, agreed to treat his injuries and then placed the young fox in a wildlife rehabilitator until he was strong enough for release. This was my first time learning about wildlife rehabilitation, and I knew instantly that I wanted to become a licensed rehabilitator, she said. In order to become certified, Bulkholz said she followed the State of Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection requirements. I began apprenticing with other licensed rehabbers, she said. Bulkholz also completed a one-day course that state offers annually, followed by an exam, she said. A minimum of 40 hours of apprenticeship are required. I also found a veterinarian who was willing to sign on to assist me with wildlife treatment as needed, such as for medications like antibiotics and anti-inflammatories, as well as providing general guidance, she said. Connecting with a veterinarian is part of the required process. About a year after deciding to become a wildlife rehabilitator, I had my certification to rehab small animals, she said. A variety of wildlife have been treated over the past 6 years. I have cared primarily for squirrels, possums, bunnies, and mice, Bulkholz said, noting her future plans include expanding her efforts. I am currently working towards becoming an RVS, that's a rabies vector species certified rehabber, so that I can care for raccoons, foxes, and skunks, she said, because these species can potentially carry the rabies virus. Special immunizations and specific caging is required to care for them. For now, many animals show up on her doorstep through the DEEP website or a Facebook group where wildlife rehabilitation caregivers can communicate with one another about wildlife in need. Sometimes I'll find critters posted by other rehabbers that I am able to take in, Bulkholz said. The spring, summer are by far the busiest times to get calls during baby season. Orphan babies are the most common calls I get, followed by animals that were dog or cat caught. And I have one more story. 3 years after buying the former Golden Lamb Buttery and 588 acres of farmland and woods in Connecticut's rural quiet corner, Lori and Venus Corvo have sold more than half the land to a national environmental nonprofit to ensure it remains undeveloped in the future. The Corvier's Little Dipper Farm in Brooklyn and its ambitious agritourism activities will remain, and their new farm glamping operation, Glamour Camping with an Agricultural Flair, will soon get underway. The Corvias are holding on to 271 acres, along with the popular Chef's Table dining operation that took the place of the Golden Lamb Buttery, an iconic restaurant in northeastern Connecticut for decades. but they've sold 317 acres of the property to the Conservation Fund, and ultimately that land will end up in the hands of the Wyndham Land Trust, Laurie Corvo said. When we first bought it, we had so many plans. We were out in those woods trying to get the trails cleaned up and make it a good place for biking, she said Thursday. Very quickly, we realized it was too much for us, and this land wasn't where the core of our property was. The sale ensures the land won't eventually wind up with real estate investors and developers looking to build shops, subdivisions, or condos. It's a good thing for the town. That land is a prime piece of property, and we don't need to have it developed, Brooklyn First Selectman Austin Tanner said Thursday afternoon. This is very good. In a statement, Wyndham Land Trust board member Janet Booth praised the Corvos for finding a way to protect the land. They breathe life into the conservation efforts of this iconic 317 acres of forest and wetland habitat in Brooklyn and Pomfret, Booth said. Importantly, these 317 acres connect to a much larger area of conserved land. Connecting large blocks of habitat is paramount to the survival of the other species that share our world and is a keystone to preserving the quality of life for all. The Conservation Fund is spending $550,000 for the 317 acres, and Corvo emphasized that it will maintain public access for hiking its 6-mile loop trails. The deal began with a sadder development in 2019 when Brooklyn lost a cherished and surprisingly well-known business after 55 years, located along remote Wolf Den Road in a town of fewer than 9,000 people. The Golden Lamb Butter nevertheless built a wide-ranging base of loyalists impressed by its early adaptation of upscale farm-to-table dining. And we're going to take our final break and be back with the rest of the front pages after that.
Located in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, Oak Hills Camp Harkness is hiring for the summer. Our fully accessible camp is designed to meet the interests and needs of children and adults along the disability spectrum by providing activities that are creative, adventurous, and fun. We are looking for counselors, lifeguards, and team leaders, just to name a few. This opportunity is perfect for recent high school graduates or college students looking to make a difference this summer. Join Oak Hill for a summer you will always remember with individuals you will never forget. Oak Hill's Camp Harkness, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
And continuing on now with the front pages, I have the obituaries by town. Starting with Avon, Nicholas E. Barr, Berlin, Barbara Kelly, Bloomfield, Gail E. Evans, and Dr. Sherwood C. Lewis. Bristol, James P. Deck, Charles A. Drury, David E. Goranson. From Canton, Lindsay R. Pinkham. From Coventry, David M. Armstrong, Thomas A. Chapman. East Granby, Glenn M. Trombley. He died a couple of months ago. I know they're going to have a celebration of his life. I believe it's today. He was a teacher in Windsor. Actually, I taught with him. He taught shop. A very lovely man, and the kids just adored him. And he retired and lived a few more years and was very involved in activities. Anyway, I wanted to give you a little biography of him because I knew Glenn. Robert L. Zawatsky, this is from East Granby. East Hartford, William A. Ballantyne, Ergo J. Ballou, Louise M. Mather. Ellington, Cynthia R. Caldwell, Thomas A. Chapman, Betty Ann Schreyer, Glastonbury, Paul E. DeSanto Sr., Ann D. Janis, Faith J. Preston, Jane Tershetta. From Hartford, Mary A. Cutler, James P. Deck, Edie Handelman, Ronald Kastner, Dr. Sherwood C. Lewis, Rachel Singer, Janet Walbridge. From Hebron, Martha E. Rowe, Betty Ann Scherer. Manchester, David M. Armstrong, Thomas Barlow, Heidi Bulgini, Phyllis M. Finney. From Marlborough, Ergel J. Ballou, Middletown, Florence Courtright, Barbara R. Hartig, and Albert L. Lara. From New Britain, John D. Heisman Sr., Ronald Kastner, Albert E. Sheary, Morris E. Skyers Jr., and Jane Turchetta. From Newington, Breen B. Bernard Sr., Angelus Giannakopoulos, I'm going to spell that, G-I-A-N-N-A-K-O-P-O-U-L-O-S, Giannakopoulos, Barbara Kelly, this is from Newington, Sandla S. Polimsky Jr., Faith J. Preston. From Simsbury, Barbara M. Griffin, Lindsay R. Pinkham, South Windsor, William A. Ballantyne, William R. Courtney, Louise C. Mother, Suffield, Linda Berghoff, Towland, Heidi Bogini, Vernon, William R. Courtney, David E. Gorenson, Waterbury, George W. McKee, West Hartford, Gregory L. Clark, Janet Walbridge, Weathersfield, George W. McKee, and Flodine Sale, S-E-H-L, Willimantic, Mary A. Cutler, Windsor, Linda Berghoff, Elaine K. Colley, James W. Johnson Sr., Robert J. Zawatsky, and Mr. Trombley, Glenn Trombley is mentioned again here, and finally in Windsor Locks, Anthime J. Liebel. Now, in other towns in Connecticut, Albert L. Lara, and out of state, here are a few names, William A. Ballantyne, Nicholas E. Barr, Mary A. Cutler, Edie Handelman, Barbara R. Hartig, John J. Heinzman Sr., Flodine Sale, and Janet Walbridge. And we're going to go to sports, and I have a few minutes left, so I'm just going to give you a few highlights. First of all, I'll give you the scores. The Yankees played a doubleheader yesterday, and they swept the Cleveland Guardians 3-2. I'm not sure what the score of the second game. It was a day-night doubleheader, and I think they'll be playing again today. The Red Sox won in Fenway Park yesterday by a score of 7-2, and the Mets, I believe, lost yesterday. I'm looking. Let's see if I can find a score. I don't see it here, but I believe they lost yesterday. Who were they playing? They were playing Kansas City. I got it now. And I do remember that Kansas City really defeated the Mets by a big score. Sorry, I couldn't find that right away, but then I just came up with it. They'll be playing again today down at Citi Field. 11-7 was the final score. Another note here, Fritz Peterson, longtime Yankees pitcher, is dead at 82. He's a staple of the Yankees starting rotation for nearly a decade, who famously swapped wives with a teammate before the 1973 season has died, the team announced. He was 82. Fred Ingles Fritz Peterson, who hailed from Chicago, made his MLB debut with the Yankees in 1966 and spent parts of the next nine seasons with them, pitching to a 109-106 record and a 3.10 ERA. Now, a little bit about the incident. It was during spring training in 1973 that Peterson and teammate Mike Kekich, also a left-handed pitcher, announced they had swapped wives, children, and dogs. While Kekich and Marilyn Peterson didn't remain a couple for long, Peterson and Suzanne Kelch, Kekich married in 1974 and stayed together. I could not be happier with anybody in the world, Peterson told the Palm Beach Post in 2013. Mama and I go out and party every night. We're still on the honeymoon, and it has been a real blessing. And I'm going to tell you what is on the air today. First, we will start with baseball. 1:30 p.m., the Angels at Boston on NESN, Radio 1080. 1:30 p.m., the Yankees again at Cleveland. That's on the YES Network, Radio 97.9. 1:30 p.m., Kansas City at the New York Mets down at Citi Field. That's on SNY, Radio 880, WCBS out of New York. And at 7 p.m., the Sunday night game on ESPN San Diego at the L.A. Dodgers. In basketball, there's a few NBA games. 1 p.m., Washington at Boston. That is on the NBC network, 1 p.m. Chicago at New York. That's an ESPN and MSG. 1 p.m. Brooklyn at Philadelphia, WCTX. And 3:30 p.m. L.A. Lakers at New Orleans. That's on ESPN. And in the NHL, Seattle at St. Louis. That's on TNT. 1 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. Colorado is at Vegas. And in golf, the Masters, and I'll give you a little information on that right now, 2 p.m. PGA Tour, the Masters final round on ESPN. And I think there's a story on Tiger Woods. Let me see what it says here. From Augusta, Georgia, Tiger Woods shot his worst round in a major championship in the third round of the Masters on Saturday, finding far too many trees off the tee and making far too many three putts on the greens for a 10-over 82 at Augusta National. Woods started the day 1-over and 7 shots off the lead, but after 8 bogeys and 2 double bogeys offset by just a pair of birdies, the 48-year-old 5-time champion was left facing an early tee time for his 100th round in the Masters on Sunday. And let me see if I can see who's leading, if I have that information here. No, I don't have the information on who's leading. I believe there are 5 players who are tied, and they'll be finishing that up today. And that's all I have for the sports. And we're going to go into the lottery numbers now for Saturday, April 13th. Play 3 day, 4-6-3, WB7. Play 4 day, 7-4-5-6, WB1. Friday's late numbers, play 3 night, 0-1-0, WB5. Play 4 night, 6-9-7-9, WB6. Lucky for life, 1-19-20. 34, 44, LB4. The lotto numbers, 2, 12, 27, 29, 35, 44. There were 0 first prize tickets sold. The Mega Millions numbers are 1, 12, 27, 29, 35, 44. There were 0 first prize tickets sold. The Mega Millions numbers, 1, 12, 14, 18, 66, MB16, MP2. Tonight's estimated lotto jackpot, $2.3 million. Tuesday's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $148 million. And we're going to try to stretch this out here a little bit. We have a little bit of time left. I'm going to give you today in history. On April 14th, in 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was shot and mortally wounded by John Wilkes Booth during a performance of Our American Cousin, and that happened at Ford's Theater in Washington. In 1912, the RMS Titanic collided with an iceberg in the North Atlantic at 11:40 p.m. ship's time and began sinking. The ship went under 2 hours and 40 minutes later with a loss of 1,514 lives. And there, of course, were a few survivors that were picked up by another ship. I think it was the Carpathia, if I remember from the movie. Anyway, in 1981, the test flight of America's first operational space shuttle, the Columbia, successfully landed at Edwards Air Force Base in California. In 1999, NATO mistakenly bombed a convoy of Albanian refugees. Yugoslav officials said 75 people were killed. And in 2021, a white former suburban Minneapolis police officer, Kim Potter, was charged with second-degree manslaughter for killing 20-year-old black motorist Dante Wright in a shooting that ignited days of unrest. And that is all for the front page for today, Sunday, April 14th. I'm Bill Murphy. I've been reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. trying to get a lot of news in as much as I can. Looks like we're going to have a nice week coming up. Tuesday is going to be in the 70s, so enjoy the weather. And we will see you later. So long for now.